This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. And this is the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of December 1st, 2025. It's now been 2 years since Phoenix faced a court-ordered deadline to clear out a massive homeless encampment downtown known as The Zone. Part of the city's response was to create a city-run campground for people experiencing homelessness. Now residents of the Safe Outdoor Space say it's working well. But what's next for the site? Catherine Davis Young reports.
Michael Travis was living in a Phoenix apartment with his sister when their rent increased almost 30%. His sister moved out, he couldn't afford the place on his own, and pretty soon he faced the extremely stressful experience of living on the street.
It's a different day every day. It's a lot of things that's going on. You got drugs going on out there, you got people dying outside.
He tried going to a homeless shelter, but says he didn't feel much safer inside the crowded, chaotic facility. Then he got a referral to Phoenix's Safe Outdoor Space. It's a 4-acre lot downtown with a huge shade structure covering about 200 tents pitched on AstroTurf. Travis has his own tent, he has his dog with him, and he says he likes the setup much better than being on the street or in a shelter.
These security are more thorough in what they do, and the staff as well.
He's been here 7 months now. Staff are working with him to find new housing and a job. He's also working toward a nursing degree.
Like, I just did a lab project for my microbiology.
Rachel Milne directs the city's Office of Homeless Solutions. Walking through the Safe Outdoor Space, she says this site has all the services that brick and mortar shelters have.
So back here, we've got all of our restrooms, hand washing stations, showers, laundry for clients.
And even though guests sleep in tents outside, there's a big air-conditioned warehouse in the middle where they can eat meals or just take a break.
This is what made this site so attractive to us. In addition to all of the shade out there, having a place where people could come inside in the summer or the winter or a monsoon to be able to escape the elements.
The site opened in 2023. In the years preceding it, a downtown homeless encampment known as The Zone had grown so large that businesses and neighbors sued. The court ordered the city to clear the encampment. City officials wanted to offer shelter space to everyone in The Zone, but Milne says,
we knew pretty quickly that not everyone was going to accept our offer of indoor sites.
So her office got city council approval to purchase this industrial lot nearby and create a safer alternative for people who preferred tents. It was not the first of its kind. University of Washington assistant professor Jade Orr has researched dozens of sites like this set up across the U.S. in recent years. She says they took off during the pandemic as homelessness increased, but tight quarters in congregate shelters posed a health risk.
In response, a lot of cities started experimenting with sanctioned encampments.
But Orr says the sites are often controversial.
There's typically a lot of pushback from neighbors, having them sited in their neighborhoods or in residential areas.
Phoenix was no different. When the idea was proposed, community members expressed concern that downtown Phoenix was already shouldering an unfair burden in terms of providing homeless services. And some asked why the city would spend money to house people in tents rather than investing more in affordable housing.
One of my stipulations was that I really thought it needed to be a temporary solution.
Bill Moreland owns an electric supply business in the neighborhood. He advocated for the city to only run the site for 3 years, and the city approved the plan with that caveat. Moreland says he thought the short time frame would give the city time to build more shelters. 2 years in, his feelings have changed. Homelessness has only increased, and he says the site is still needed, and it hasn't been disruptive in his neighborhood.
I would hope to see them continue to fund it at the levels that it's being funded and continue it.
Funding could be a challenge. Pandemic-era federal aid that has boosted city and county budgets for homeless services for the last few years expires in 2026. Milne says it will be up to the city council to decide what happens to this site after its third year.
Might not look exactly like this a year from now or 2 years from now, but we've proven that this is a well-run program.
More than 2,000 people have now come through the site. About 30% have gone on to treatment, indoor shelter, or housing. Milne says that's a better success rate than some other shelters in the city. Alex Fuentes has been staying at the site for about a month. He likes the tents. He likes the staff.
I've been through a lot of shelters, but this is one of the best ones yet.
He says he not only wants to see this site continue, but hopes more like it will open in the future.
All shelters should operate like this.
Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In politics news, the month-long government shutdown put a focus on food banks across the state, which stepped up to feed hundreds of thousands of Arizonans who usually rely on federal food assistance that was paused during the stalemate. Even with that funding restored, those food banks may face an increased demand in the coming years due to changes made to the program by the Republican tax cut and spending package passed earlier this year. From the Politics Desk, Wayne Shutsky reports.
On a recent tour of food banks around the state, Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego stopped by Nourish, south of downtown Phoenix, and helped hand out food to families ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday.
You hand your ticket over here?
All right.
I'm gonna say, first cart, first visit.
First cart, first visit.
Gallego visited the food bank just weeks after the end of the shutdown, which had caused demand at food banks to spike due to an interruption in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Usually food banks fill a gap, providing meals for people who don't qualify for SNAP but still struggle to afford groceries every month. Jensina Sethi, a volunteer coordinator with Nourish, says that gap widened during the shutdown.
Typical is about 200, but after the SNAP thing, it jumped to 250 right away. I've been here 4 years, and 4 years ago, it was 70 families a day.
While some Phoenix area food banks have seen numbers return to normal, Sethi says demand at Nourish hasn't gone down, even with SNAP benefits restored.
Yesterday, we did 306 50-pound food boxes plus turkeys.
Gallego says he's hearing that same message from food banks around the state.
And unfortunately, we're hearing, yes, that demand is up. They're able to meet demand thanks to a lot of great support, corporate, profit support, and volunteers. But it's scary that there's a lot of people who need these type of food boxes.
That's left officials and advocates worried that the shutdown could end up being a preview for what will happen when changes to the SNAP program included in President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill go into effect. Those changes include new expanded work requirements for many adults between 18 and 64 who receive SNAP benefits. According to the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, around 124,000 Arizonans could lose benefits under the new requirements. Terry Shoemaker is with the Arizona Food Bank Network.
We already know that there are about 700,000 people each month seeking help from food banks, and that's just going to get worse if fewer people qualify for help.
The federal government has historically covered almost all SNAP costs, but Trump's bill changes that. It will increase states' share of administrative costs and require some states to cover a portion of food assistance if they make too many mistakes in determining eligibility. States must keep that error rate below 6% starting in late 2027 to avoid the penalty. Arizona's preliminary rate this year was over 10%. Supporters, like House Speaker Mike Johnson, argued the changes to SNAP and other social programs were needed to combat alleged waste and fraud in the system.
Pregnant women, children, seniors, single mothers, the disabled, and the low-income Americans among us receiving Medicaid and SNAP will have the peace of mind of knowing that we've made these safety nets stronger.
During a visit in September to St. Mary's Food Bank, Democratic officials, including Governor Katie Hobbs, argued the bill's provisions are actually just a way to shift spending onto states to pay for tax cuts backed by Trump. Legislative budget analysts estimate the error rate penalty alone could cost Arizona up to $140 million during its first year in effect. The work requirements could also cost Arizona just under $300 million in federal funding as people lose benefits. Hobbs has long said the state doesn't have the money to make up for those losses.
We are going to rely more and more on community partners like the St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance and other folks who are meeting those basic needs because of the federal cuts.
More recently, Hobbs said she will ask state lawmakers to come up with money to help offset some of those cuts when the legislative session begins in January. But the Republicans who control the state legislature have voiced support for the federal changes, arguing the only people who will lose benefits are those who shouldn't have had them in the first place. Democrats reject that argument and say Arizonans with real need will lose SNAP, forcing food banks to serve more and more people. Shoemaker, with the Arizona Food Bank Network, shares those concerns, but...
What I do know is that food banks are very resourceful.
Back at Nourish, Sethi says her organization is ready to take on that challenge, for now.
St. Mary's said they would keep sending us food as much as we can, and we've seen a lot of donors step up and give us some money to purchase food because we can purchase it a lot cheaper. So we just encourage people, if you have the means, to donate money to us, and we can buy food, and we will feed as many people as we can.
The full impact of the Big Beautiful Bill on food assistance won't be known for some time. The new work requirements are going into effect now, but other changes won't take effect until as late as 2027. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizonans who rely on SNAP are now facing even more uncertainty after the Trump administration threatened to withhold funding from states like Arizona that refused to turn over data about those receiving assistance. And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In today's fast-paced world, where misinformation spreads rapidly, KJZZ fills the gap with trusted factual reporting. You can help keep this perfect mix of local, national, and global news strong when you donate to fill the gap in funding. Make your financial gift at kjzz.org today, and thank you. In business news, when covering a story, journalists must try to answer the five basic W's: who, what, when, where, and why. Through our Q&A Z reporting project, we received a question about a small southern Arizona community with a peculiar name. So Al Macias applied the five W's to try to find out, why is why named why?
The great Yankees catcher Yogi Berra dispensed many memorable pearls of wisdom, including this one: when you come to the fork in the road, take it. And this question, why the community of Why is named Why, took me to a fork in the road. Why, that's spelled W-H-Y, sits on a lonely spot in southern Arizona, 124 miles west of Tucson and 12 miles south of the old mining town of Ajo. State routes 85 and 86 intersect here, and many years ago, it was a Y-shaped intersection. Most travelers headed to the Mexican beach town of Rocky Point pass through Why without stopping unless they need to top off their gas tanks or grab some last-minute supplies.
Sometimes, yeah, they do ask. They're like, why is Why called Why?
Cordelia Hamilton is a clerk at the Why Not Travel Store and Gas Station, where the question is often asked. If the inspiration came from the old intersection, why then is the community named W-H-Y? Why not just the letter Y?
We point them to a plaque that's above our thermostat, and it, you know, kind of explains why is called Y.
The plaque refers to a state law, but that law doesn't exist, and apparently never did. Martha McConnell is with the State of Arizona Research Library. She says residents
were told that the law requires them to name the town using a name that has at least three letters. So I went looking for that law, and I didn't find it.
McConnell did a thorough search of the Arizona Revised Statute, an earlier version of the statutes, and its predecessor, the 1939 Arizona Code. But she says they all said the same thing.
The people in the town circulate a petition and advise what they want the name of the town to be, and that's what starts the process.
But Why is a tiny unincorporated community with a population of just 122 people in the 2020 census, and it has never been a formally recognized town. And whether it's incorporated or not, there is no state law, and apparently never was, that required at least a three-letter name. Another theory is that there was a postal regulation requiring at least three letters. There wasn't. In fact, there was a Y, Alaska, near Anchorage, just the letter Y. But Why Alaska adopted a wholesale name change in 2010 and is now known as Susitna North. Back in Why, Arizona, 91-year-old Jose Flores heard over the years that there was a woman who settled out in the desert and sold tequila smuggled from Mexico to locals in the area. In his words, she was a bootlegger.
Y de ahí viene esa historia. Es porque.
He says people asked her why, porque in Spanish, she moved out there. So that's another theory. Up the road in Ajo is another longtime resident, 85-year-old Bud Kleinfelter. He says many of the people who settled in Why wanted to be left alone.
That was about the only advantage to living out there was the isolation and the fact that there was very limited neighbors. You didn't have to put up with neighbors. And most of them folks that lived out there, you didn't want them around you anyway. So, you know, they were different folks. They weren't bad people, they were just different.
He recalls how that Y intersection, which has since been reconfigured to a T shape, was the site of many bad car wrecks. Despite the sign and maps that identify the community as Y, most residents still know Y as the Y.
We called it the Y, and it was just Y. In fact, it was years before I realized it was W-H-Y. We just thought it was the Y. We actually used to ride our bikes out there. I rode my bikes all the way out there a couple times when I was young.
Joe Gonzalez grew up in Ajo and passes Y several times a week.
And again, when I say, I don't even say Y, I say the Y, like everybody else does. All locals call it the Y.
So despite the legends, no one seems to really know how Y became Y, who was behind the naming, exactly when it happened, or what prompted it. But when it comes to finding out why is named why, the story ain't over until it's over. For KJZZ News, I'm Al Macias, reporting from Why.
If you're curious about something in the state, you can ask your own question by going to qaz.kjzz.org. In Fronteras News, businesses in the center of Sonora, Mexico's capital Hermosillo, are hoping the Christmas shopping season brings much-needed relief after a deadly explosion left the commercial zone quieter than usual in November. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Nina Kravinsky reports.
In a crowded pedestrian-only shopping zone in Hermosillo's busy downtown, families pose in front of a giant Christmas tree, and people haggle for produce and goodies on the street corners. But just over a month ago, an explosion and fire in a nearby discount store that killed 24 people left this area quiet. Small business owners are now struggling to recoup their losses. Ruben Lopez Peralta is the owner of Colorful Las Chulas restaurant and president of an association that represents downtown businesses. There was a certain amount of fear of going downtown, he says, and the businesses in his area lost about 50% of their revenue last month. At a park a block away from the site of last month's explosion, lifelong Hermosillo resident Luis Eduardo Diaz is out shopping. After what happened, the environment is tense, he says. It's his habit to come to this part of the city, but he says other people are starting to think twice. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news, the superintendent of the Paradise Valley Unified School District could soon be terminated. As Bridget Dowd reports from the Education Desk, the district's governing board began the process for dismissal Tuesday night.
At a special meeting, the board adopted a statement of 14 charges against Superintendent Todd Cummings, including exhibiting an improper attitude, engaging in disrespectful conduct towards subordinate employees, and failing to disclose pertinent information on his application for employment. The board was not tasked with determining if the allegations are true, but deciding if the district has sufficient cause to dismiss Cummings if they are true. The board voted unanimously to serve Cummings with the statement of charges. If he does not request a hearing within 10 days of receiving it, Cummings will lose his job. He was hired in April and put on leave in October. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from KJZZ's original production, The Show. How will Arizona Senator Kelly's viral video and investigation affect his political future? Here's co-host Mark Brody.
Arizona Senator Mark Kelly continues to criticize both President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth over military strikes in the Caribbean. This, of course, follows Hegseth saying his department was investigating Kelly over his involvement in a video reminding military members that they should not follow illegal orders. Trump, for his part, has called the video seditious and originally called for the members of Congress who recorded it to be executed. The president later walked back those comments and said he was not threatening death. The story continues to be generating attention, and Arizona senior senator continues to be at the center of it. And while that has policy and safety implications, it also has political impacts for Kelly. With me to talk about that last part is Chuck Coughlin of High Ground Public Affairs. And Chuck, what do you make of everything going on between Trump, Hegseth, and Kelly? They've all had some pretty harsh language for each other. So from Kelly's perspective, what do you make of all this?
I think it's great for him. I mean, he's exploiting this opportunity that is suggesting, rightly so, that officers and people in the military shouldn't obey illegal orders. Pretty broad statement, right? But it clearly planted in the Trump fish mouth there, and he's been fishing away with it ever since, because there's all these orders that we all are wondering about, with all the drug boats getting destroyed in Central America, with the positioning of American troops in mm-hmm. American cities. You know, you have all this kind of anxiety that is created, and so it's a perfect foil for him with his record as a astronaut and as a fighter pilot, and to remind people what the military code of justice says.
Well, so do you have to separate out the pure politics from it, from everything else? Because Kelly has talked about how, you know, he's gotten more death threats since President Trump called him seditious and called for him to be executed. Like, how do you sort of separate that out or balance the potential political gain versus maybe everything else that goes with something like this?
It's part of the narrative today. It is what Trump has done, as what he's created is this threatening narrative and this constituency. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene was getting death threats. Mm-hmm. And so in following that, this is a general line of thinking that goes on now, and I think he knows it. I think he's got to know it. And he knows that it freezes his political opposition to some degree. Marjorie Taylor Greene's going to leave the House now.
Yeah.
You know, he bullied her out. You know, going back to the Jeff Flake here, he bullied Jeff Flake out. He's bullied a bunch of people out of the game. And you wonder where the end of that string runs. Kelly has brought about a narrative possibility for a change here because it's over the top.
Well, so what are the advantages to Kelly? Obviously, I would think name ID would be one of them. For people who maybe don't know who he is already, this certainly elevates his name ID. Are there other benefits to him besides that?
I think so. I think it creates, you know, he was on the short list for a discussion on the vice presidential ticket last time. And so he has this sort of perfect narrative lined up. And so, you know, this is the kind of narrative that would appeal to a much broader audience that the Democrats have had difficulty communicating with because of their romance with identity politics has prevented them from being able to reach a broader audience. So Kelly provides that template, and I think this narrative in particular provides him that opportunity to distinguish himself and drive it. The question is it enough? What more is there here, and is he doing enough with that?
Right. Well, certainly, I mean, there have been plenty of foils to President Trump, and not suggesting in any way that Mark Kelly's purpose in putting this video out or participating in this video was purely politics. I don't want to get into anybody's motivation or get into anybody's head.
I can do that.
you're welcome to do that. I will stay away from that. But like, there's certainly plenty of other foils to President Trump right now. You think about California Governor Gavin Newsom. You think about many others. Does this in any way set Kelly apart? And if so, like, what does he do with this? If he's getting more name ID, if it's helping set the narrative, what does he do with it?
Yeah. That's the question as you go into the next presidential cycle after this midterm's up. First and foremost, can you undermine Trump in the midterms? Can you create a patriotic narrative about your country, your service, your commitment, and your philosophical commitment about the country and what it stands for, and contrast that with Trump as an effective foil in a midterm election? Can you create a platform on which you can operate off of and communicate with broadly in the course of this midterm election to assist other candidates, to assist in reimagining what the Democratic Party is? Can this become a part of that Democratic Party going forward? That would be the midterm goal. And then beyond that is – it is up to him to decide what else to do with this. I think it's a little thin gruel to think that you can drive this thing into the presidential cycle. It's a stepping stone.
Yeah.
But as we saw, what Trump did with the Republican Party is he flipped it on its head. And you really need to do that again with today, because the existing narratives about the two parties are not helpful to the Democratic Party.
I'm wondering if you see any comparison or parallel between what we've been talking about with Mark Kelly and the new member of Congress from Arizona's 7th Congressional District, yeah. Adelita Grijalva. Obviously, the situations are very different, the circumstances. But she was put in a situation that was not really of her making, but at least politically, just politics, she really seemed to try to make the most of it and build her name ID. And like, am I looking for a comparison that's not there?
No, it's there. But she was a classic example of what's wrong with the current system. Republicans control everything. And they wouldn't even seat her in Congress. They wouldn't even give – that district was held voiceless because of strictly partisanship. But, you know, they use that for a period of time. They'll continue to use it to vilify the Speaker of the House, as they should, for not swearing her in instantaneously. I mean, that's incredibly partisan behavior, which I don't think most Americans support.
Obviously, I'm not hearing anybody talking about Adelita Grijalva running for president as we're talking about Mark Kelly potentially running for president in 3 years. But like, what does she do with her new name ID boost? Like, obviously, not everybody knows who she is now, but I would imagine more people know her name and who she is now than had she not been precluded from taking her seat for more than a month.
I mean, if I'm Senator Kelly, I'm hauling her around with me as a class one example of our broken system today and why it needs to be changed. And if I'm her, a freshman congressman, one of 435 members in Congress who has less seniority than anybody else in Congress, I'm jumping on that train. I'm going to see where that train can help me boost my name ID, help me boost my fundraising potential. You know, remember when AOC won in New York against an established Democrat? You know, I would try and mimic from her perspective, how to navigate her career in that way that gives her a bigger platform to work off of.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Chuck Coughlin with High Ground Public Affairs. Chuck, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Great being here, Mark. Thanks for the opportunity.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online and on the KJZZ mobile app.